Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Safe. And by the way, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Castro, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Spotify, and Stitcher. And I will admit, I don't even know what half of those are, but if you go there, you can subscribe to this podcast, and we really do appreciate it. Well, we are joined today by Kevin Williamson of National Review, who wrote a piece about a debate he had with Sohrab Ahmari. I know the debate, the Sohrab Ahmari versus David French debate, you know, has been discussed, but Kevin Williamson wrote a piece in which he described Sohrab as a bantamweight Mussolini, and that alone is enough, is worth the price of admission to the Bulwark Podcast. So, Kevin, thanks for coming back. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about this. You live in Texas, but you've been traveling a lot. You were up at Yale for the William F. Buckley Society for a debate with Sohrab, and it sounds like you guys didn't really get along that well.
Oh, it was more of a panel discussion than a debate. And I didn't really talk to him personally very much, kind of on purpose. But, we just see the world differently. And I thought that, and I continue to think that some of his ideas aren't very well thought out and aren't very easily defensible. And a lot of it is kind of personality driven stuff, you know, thus the weird fixation on David French and all that. So I led into him a little bit, and I spent part of a panel discussion beating on him a little. And then I wrote a piece about it, which was probably meaner than it needed to be, but, you know, meaner than it needed to be is pretty much my.
Yeah, you did mention that you debated, his contention that the main duty of the state is not to protect liberty, but to achieve the good, biblically defined.
Right.
That's what he said when he showed up anyway. He was a bit late owing to the fact that the state he would entrust to do God's work here on earth cannot quite manage to make the trains run on time, a fact that you might think would be of some interest to a bantamweight Mussolini. So you tied all that together. And that was the moment where and having read your book, which I want to talk about, including the poo flinging monkeys, is that you are really at the stage, Kevin, where you are all out of bleeps to give. You can tell that I've matured to the point that I don't actually say it. But you really don't care whether people like you, do you?
No, I don't. I mean, not in a professional capacity anyway. You care more in your personal life, I suppose. But I like to think that I have fewer but better friends is maybe how I do it. It is a theme of the book that I think that not only is it that I don't care, it's that it's worse than that in some ways. The desire to be liked, to be approved of, to be popular is, I think, an enormous problem for American writers, and especially political writers and political advocates, where it's very difficult for them to criticize their own side, as you certainly know. It's very difficult for them to resist the urge to play to the crowd, to deliver applause lines, that sort of thing, to own the libs on our side. And I think that really debases our discourse and makes for a lot of really bad, tedious, unbearable, and uninteresting writing. And if anything, that's probably my principal complaint with Sohrab in many ways, is that a lot of his writing on this seems to me very calculated to build a particular kind of commercially viable audience. And I know that I'm not attributing this to him as a matter of bad faith. I think it's a natural instinct for a lot of writers of the kind of writing that we do, but it's one that really needs to be resisted. So there's a kind of great liberation in deciding that, well, you know what, I'm never going to write a book that sells 5 million copies. So I'm not going to ever get to stop flying commercial or anything like that. And that's okay. But what I can do, though, is write what I actually think. And there is a great deal of liberation in that. And so as a purely commercial thing, I've discovered that still works well enough to work well enough. And this kind of, you know, pandering, acting like you're running for Congress way of writing about politics and writing about social affairs, I think is really just gross.
Well, you know, the book, by the way, I should have mentioned it right up at the top, The Smallest Minority Independent Thinking in the Age of Mob Politics. I'm going to get to every element of that, but you use one of the key words, which is, of course, liberating, when you just stop pandering. And you write in the book that the original sin of American intellectuals is his desire to be popular. And you describe the mind of the political journalist as a contemptible union of neediness and arrogance. And you declare, I am not your friend, your advocate, or your tribune. And I have to tell you, you really caught me in the first chapter of the book when you're describing being at one of these tedious panel discussions, and you're there with Cleta Mitchell from Foley and Lardner, and she, of course, is one of the Beltway insider populists who has gone full Trumpy. And I love the moment where she accused you of being one of these inside the Beltway Republican establishment types.
Yeah.
And then you proceed to dismantle her, pointing out that in every possible definition of that term, she is defined. I mean, just, you know, wrote the book on lobbying. You know, literally.
She literally works inside the Beltway, appears on a Fox News show called The Insiders, and wrote the standard book on being a lobbyist in Washington called The Lobbyist Compliance Handbook, and actually works for the Republican Party. And I'm neither a Republican nor someone who lives inside the Beltway or ever has. Is Arlington inside the Beltway? I lived there for about 10 months. Maybe I did. And that was a long, long time ago, though. You're not a member of the party, much less part of the establishment. You're not someone who lives inside the Beltway, who works for politicians or works for political parties or things like that. And, you know, I'm a guy who lives in Texas and drives around the country and tries to see what's going on and tell people what I think about it, in a way that often is alienating to the people who would be my quote unquote constituency if I thought of it that way. I remember, you know, in the whole Atlantic episode, one of the weird lines of criticism that was leveled at me was, well, why would they hire this guy in the first place? It's not like he speaks for some particular faction. It's not as though there's a Kevin Williamson school of conservatism. And I thought, well, you're right. But, you know, they didn't hire me to represent a political constituency. They hired me to write about, well, mostly to write about poor white people.
You describe this, the independent thinker, as the smallest minority. And I think we're going to go around this in sort of a different way. Why is it so hard to be an independent thinker? And why are there so few of them? Is it just the commercial pressures?
No, I don't think it's just the commercial pressures, although that's certainly an aspect for people who are professional writers. But if anything, this tendency is even stronger and more pronounced and more hysterical among people who aren't, who are just, you know, people who are on Twitter and Facebook and talk radio callers and that sort of thing, who do this kind of thing on a volunteer basis, incredibly enough, which I wonder what's wrong with them a little bit. I think that the social pressure comes from the fact that we are increasingly turning to not exactly politics, because it's not really about politics, but a kind of political identity as a substitute for other sorts of relationships that we used to have. So as people put off marriage, they put off parenthood, members of the more educated and higher income demographic move a lot more. They have fewer community ties. People go to church less than they used to, that sort of thing. They've got this opening for a defining meaning inferring relationship in their life, and for some reason they're settling on politics. And it's strange in that it's mostly not about political policy and political policy differences. In fact, if you look at the polling information, most people don't really have a very good idea of what the candidates they support actually believe on the issues, or the candidates on the other side for that matter. But they have this very, very, very strong sense of identification with a particular tribe, which is represented by a particular president or presidential candidate, which is why our presidential politics especially have gotten so poisonous and weird and kind of quasi-ceremonial and religious in a sense, where what's going on there is really more about a kind of sacrosanct expression of community value than it is about whether the top tax rate is going to be this or our policy towards Syria is going to be that. And that I think is what makes it very difficult for people, because people are afraid of being alone. People are afraid of being party of one.
They're afraid of being cast out from the tribe.
Yeah, there's a natural tendency in the human animal to want to belong to the local social group. And the local social group now has moved from the actual, literally local group to being people on Twitter and social media and that sort of thing. And it's ultimately ends up being about status panic, you know, anxiety about social status. And so I want to fit into this group and I derive a sense of status from this group. And this group has to have status relative to that other group, because status is always relative. It's never absolute. So our politics becomes about denigrating the other side and trying to raise the status of your side. And that's the weird thing about like the I love science people and or make America great again. It's all about this rhetorical status game that would be clear and obvious and transparently shallow to any 8-year-old who was sufficiently educated to understand the words and the sentences. But we've really done a wonderful job of brainwashing ourselves to the point that it's all kind of invisible to us.
So you've been part of the conservative tribe for a long time. I've been part of the conservative tribe. And there was a time when we felt like we understood who they were, what the principles were. There was a certain amount of elbow room where people could disagree. You could criticize presidents even. You could have various heterodox sorts of attitudes. And yet it has now morphed into the you cannot engage in real independent thought without the risk of excommunication. Now, in your career, I'm looking at some of the books you've written in the past. You were part of the conservative mainstream, right? I mean, you saw your line as pushing a certain ideology. Do you feel you're doing that now, or you feel like it's just been broken, that the chrysalis has been broken and you're basically on your own rethinking things in a completely different way? You know what I'm saying? You know, from the Kevin Williamson of 10 years ago sitting down to write to the Kevin Williamson right now, are you a different writer? Is the being an independent, you've always been an independent thinker, but is it different in quality now?
Yeah, I mean, some things have changed, although I think there's been less change in my attitude about, you know, conservative movement and conservative advocacy than there has really been a change in my attitude about the country. I've always known that there was an element of corruption and careerism and intellectual laziness and dishonesty in political writing and political advocacy and in politics as such. That's normal. It's there. You know, I mean, you go over to Fox News, you talk to a couple of people and you're like, okay, gotcha. And yeah, you're the man of the people on 77th and Park. And we got you. So that never really bothered me so much, although the Trump era has certainly revealed to me that is much wider and deeper and more prevalent than I had thought it was. You know, I thought of it as about a sort of maybe a 15 to 20% tendency. And now it's looking like sort of a 50 to 60% tendency. And that may be unfair and unkind of me, but it's worse than I thought it was. But what's really changed for me is my attitude about the actual country I live in and the society I live in. And that the people of the country have so thoroughly abandoned any notion of, you know, active and responsible citizenship is really the driving force here. I mean, the people on the market are just giving the market what the market is asking for. I don't blame Sean Hannity for being Sean Hannity any more than I blame someone who produces porn for producing porn. I don't think it's the most honorable way to make a living, but they didn't create the demand in the marketplace. So I feel increasingly, this is what has changed. So when I wrote The End is Near, It's Going to Be Awesome, I often describe myself as being a short-term pessimist, long-term optimist. And I would still say that that's the case, but my short-term pessimism is much more extensive and intense and maybe a little less short-term than it was. My optimism maybe is a little bit attenuated. I think the main problem with the United States in terms of our political culture, it should be obvious, but maybe it isn't. It's that things are the way they are because this is how people want them to be. This is not some development that happened out of nowhere. It's the result of preferences and choices and decisions that people made. And it's not just some, you know, swamp full of evil people up in Washington. It's, you know, it's everybody. It's the actual culture and the civilization in which we live or leave. Self-deportation is always an option.
So this raises questions about the state of our democracy. I mean, you comment on our current politics as you described it as mob madness, mass hysteria, and vicious tribalism, which doesn't really seem that controversial. So where are we? Where are we as a democracy? We often celebrate. I'm part of a number of organizations that have democracy in the title, and every once in a while I'm tempted to say, exactly what does democracy mean? And is democracy really a good idea? You seem to be increasingly skeptical about democracy, particularly as the voice of mass man, the new mass man.
Yeah, I mean, there are two different things you mean by democracy. And I guess, you know, I would say I take sort of John Adams' view of this. John Adams, I quote fairly extensively in the book, which is that democracy as a procedure is not only useful, it's irreplaceable. It's the only real viable alternative we have to violence, to knocking each other over the head when we disagree about something. And if you look at situations in which a country has lost its procedural democracy, like Hong Kong or the United Kingdom, specifically in the case of Brexit, where their vote seems not to be enough to get done what needs to get done, then you really appreciate what its absence means for a country. So I don't sneer at democracy in that sense. What I do sneer at, I suppose, is the idea of democracy as an ethos, is democracy as a good in and of itself, rather than just as a wrench that we use to turn a particular kind of bolt. And the idea that a principle or a proposition or a country more closely approaches perfection, the greater number or share of the population that agrees with it at any given moment or accedes to it at any given moment. And of course, these majorities often are temporary. They're almost always fickle. Things change really very quickly. You know, if you just look at, you know, the history of Gallup polling on issue X, Y, or Z, you'll see wild swings from one way to the other. So the idea that there's some kind of sacrosanct thing about the voice of the people and we the people, and I especially hate this rhetoric of, you know, we the people versus Washington. You know, kiss my ass. Washington got that way because we the people made the decisions they did. So that kind of rhetoric I find dumb and unhelpful and really positively destructive. The idea that the larger the mob, the holier it is, the better it is, the more intelligent it is, I think it flies in the face of almost all the available evidence and is not really a very useful political guiding principle. So this is why all the best things about the American mode of government really are the anti-democratic ones, like the Bill of Rights, which says you idiots don't get to vote on free speech or freedom of religion or whether we quarter troops in your house or these sorts of things, that we've settled these as moral matters, as ethical matters, and as political matters, and we made up a list of them, and that's that. And now theoretically, we can go back and revise that list, but we made it really, really hard to do for that reason, because people are dumb and easily scared and able to be swayed by demagogues and by corruption and by all the rest of those things.
And that seems to be getting worse. Okay, so I want to continue this conversation. I want to talk about intolerance, and I want to talk about the monkeys, and I want to talk about why you hate the monkeys. But we're going to do that in a couple of minutes. First, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Simply Safe. A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime, more than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. And that's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's really easy to order and easy to set up, usually in less than an hour. Simply Safe has won a ton of awards from CNET to the New York Times Wire Cutter. And prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So visit simplysafe.com/bulwark. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/bulwark so they know that our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/bulwark. Okay, we're back with Kevin Williamson, who writes at the National Review and other places. All right, so let's talk about the monkeys, all right? I want to read you something from your introduction. If you've ever been to the Monkey House, one of those awful downscale zoos that smell very intensely the way you imagine that Bernie Sanders probably smells faintly, you know what monkeys, these particular monkeys, are like. They jerk off and fling poo all day, generally using the same hand for both. And they don't do a hell of a lot else unless there's McDonald's. All day, jerk off, fling poo, jerk off, fling poo, jerk, fling, Twitter, basically.
Yeah.
And after about 300,000 years of evolution, here we are again, monkeys, albeit monkeys with Wi-Fi. You could try being human beings. You could try a little freedom on for size and see how it fits and feels. You aren't going to. We both know that. Jerk off, fling poo, etc. I hate monkeys. This is their story. This is how you begin your book. So have we become the monkeys? Or is it just Twitter? Or is Twitter really, is really Twitter who we are?
It is. You know, social media is like alcohol in the sense that it really reveals what you are. It doesn't change what you are. It limits, it removes inhibitions and lets us let our freak flag fly. As a little matter of pulling back the literary curtain, that opening paragraph is actually the toned down version of the opening of the book. The original version that I turned in was one of the few times anyone at Regnery has ever said to me, no, we just can't do this. You know, we're willing to let you be profane and drop in 97 F-bombs, which I think is the number I did a search and find before I turned in the subject in the manuscript. But the opening, actual opening sentences, they couldn't print in good conscience, but I'll send them over to.
So you were working through something. I mean, that's where when a writer sits down and there's some passion burning and it's like, I'm letting loose. That's the experience.
Yeah. So
you had the volcanic experience.
When I was a youngster, when I was first out of college, you know, I worked in India for an Indian newspaper chain, and I lived in Delhi. And I get into this book a little bit. There are a lot of monkeys in Delhi. This is 20, 25 years ago, and Delhi's just covered up in monkeys. And they occasionally really hurt someone badly, and they cause all sorts of trouble. But for religious reasons, you can't really interfere with monkeys in India. And so you see them all over the place, and they're just an absolute plague. And they're just human enough to make you think, you know, this is kind of what people actually are like if you let them be like them. And one of the things I discovered, though, was that they really love is McDonald's. People go to the temple to make offerings, and they leave stuff for the monkeys. And the people who don't really know what they're doing get bananas because they think that's what monkeys like. But monkeys really like Happy Meals, apparently.
Tourists.
At least the ones in India. Actually, one of the stories I wrote for that newspaper, I covered the opening of the first McDonald's in India, which was kind of actually very interesting.
That would be cool.
But, so I think of these monkeys kind of just causing trouble, not really knowing what they're doing. They have a couple of, you know, compulsions. One is to eat, the other one is to jerk off. And we are, I think, quickly allowing ourselves to devolve in that kind of direction because we don't really have any aesthetic or moral sensibility left that is strong enough to control us.
Okay, so why is this happening? Are we dumbed down? Is it social media? Is it what? Obviously,
yeah,
Donald Trump is a symptom of that, not simply a cause, right? I mean, this dysfunction has been some time coming. Have we always been this stupid and it just took Twitter to expose it? Or?
Well, I think Twitter did reveal a bunch of things. You know, the great promise of the early days of the internet was anyone can be a publisher, anyone can write something and let the whole world know. And then we discovered, well, most people are idiots and that the world is not actually made better by connecting them to each other. So social media has done a number of strange things that are kind of perverse, you know, connects everyone to everyone, but in the process created a new form of loneliness. And I think that really drives people. I think that there is a, related to a little bit to what I was saying before, not really too much, but there is a status anxiety that comes from the decline of old-fashioned relationships and places where we got our sense of status and meaning and connectedness. In the book, I argue that this is sort of a minor version of what happened at the end of the Middle Ages and the birth of what would eventually become known as capitalism, where people became wealthier and better off in material terms. You know, they had more to eat, better clothes, better housing, all that stuff. They also got politically more free, but this upset a lot of long-standing social relationships. So, you know, the relationship between lord and serf was pretty well settled, and your status in life was fixed by your relationship to the land. And whatever other problems you had in life, you didn't have social anxieties. You didn't have status anxieties because you didn't go up and you didn't go down. So as people got wealthier and freer, they acquired those anxieties and they didn't like it. And so you see at the end of the Middle Ages and the early parts of what would eventually become capitalism, the birth of things like nationalism, various kinds of religious fundamentalism. The Reformation really in some ways comes out of that. At least that's Eric Fromm's argument, who I rely on quite a bit in the book. And so globalization, what we, you know, call, for lack of a better word, this change in the way we produce and distribute and collaborate economically, has done much the same thing. It's leaving people better off and in some ways making us more free than we used to be. We certainly have a lot more choices about a lot of things than we used to. But, you know, my dad's generation, guys, then you would get a job, you work for one company your whole lifetime, or my dad worked for two companies basically his entire adult life. Kids are getting out of college right now will have an average of something like 40 different employers over the course of their lives. And or is it 25? I can't remember the number I actually read, but 10 different employers before they're 40, that sort of thing. So there's a lot more movement, a lot less connectedness, and a lot less predictability in people's lives. And a lot of people, I think, given a choice, would take some off of their salary or their income or their material well-being in exchange for predictability and stability in life. And that is, I think, a source of a lot of the anxiety and outrage and unhappiness that has accompanied these changes that have actually made us better off in material terms.
This anxiety also, though, it extends toward having the correct opinion, to dial back to our first comment here, because having the wrong friends, having the wrong opinion, saying the wrong words, using the wrong pronouns, can affect this status, this sense of identity. So along these same lines, you wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago that I wanted to ask you about Ellen DeGeneres and the politics of cooties.
Yeah.
And this, of course, Ellen DeGeneres committed the cardinal sin of actually enjoying a beer with George W. Bush. And half the country thought this was a great example of the way that we reached across divides and were human beings. And then, of course, the usual folks decided that this was some sort of a thought crime. Nobody should be friends with George W. Bush, read the headline over Sarah Jones's essay in New York. So you talked about this whole politics of the eternal politics of cooties, which raises the question, who is more intolerant these days, the right or the left?
The right.
Okay.
well, again, maybe it just seems that way to me because I'm more connected to the right. I mean, I don't read a lot of left-wing
publication. But you've experienced it both ways. But you've experienced it both ways, so that's why it's interesting.
Well, sure, and it's really silly, and it really is this very, you know, lunch counter, lunch table, middle school cafeteria kind of level of politics. You mentioned that piece I read about Seurat earlier. You know, Mark McCorgan, who writes a lot for National Review, is a big immigration restrictionist. That's kind of his thing in life. He works for an immigration restrictionist organization. And he and I have some disagreements about that. And I think he's wrong on some things. But he's a pretty good guy and he's not an evil person. And I was poking fun of him a little bit. And I refer to him as Mark Krikorian of the Mayflower Krikorians, because I think it's great that our leading advocate of immigration restriction has such a wonderfully unassimilated name. But I also described him accurately, I think, as my friend in the piece. And I heard from some, you know, lefty critic, well, you say X, Y, and Z about him, then you say you're his friend. And I just wanted to say, I got lots of friends who have bad political ideas that I disagree with on issues that I think are important, including issues that I think are morally important. For the record, I don't think Ellen had a beer with George W. Bush. I don't think he drinks.
Oh, okay.
But,
all right.
Yeah. But so he and Donald Trump have that in common,
I'm hoping that she does. So.
Yeah. Yeah, she's an interesting character. Serious wristwatch fetish this woman has.
Really?
She's going to have several million dollars worth of watches. She bought an $800,000 antique rare Rolex the other day.
I'm going to have to tell Jonathan Last that because he is somehow into watches.
Horologist, yeah.
So going back to the smallest minority being independent thinkers, is there anything that you have written in the last year that you wrote and you thought, no, I can't publish that because there would be these consequences. I'm down to the absolute rock bottom minimum number of friends, and I can't say X.
No, I don't do that. You know, so the kind of writing that I do a lot of, especially my print work, which is more long form and reported, and, you know, partly incorporates some subjective stuff where I'm writing about my experiences and my impressions of things and that sort of stuff. And there's often, you know, there's a tendency to want to self-censor there sometimes. So I know I've written things where I say, if I write this and publish it this way, someone's going to call me a racist. And, but I mean, my value as a journalist is in, you know, saying what I actually see and experience and find. And so I think what would be journalistically more valuable if I declined to publish things because I thought that doing so would be bad for my career or might make me not look good. You know, this is especially a difficult problem for someone like me who is not naturally inclined to be good. You know, not all of my thoughts do me credit. Not all my immediate reactions to things are always good, but I try to write about them honestly anyway, because I think that makes for more interesting and more useful work. So I haven't really self-censored anything exactly in the last couple of years that way. I mean, I've made a conscious decision for a number of reasons to write less about the president than maybe your average political writer does, and more than I used to, or less than I used to. For one thing, he just bores me to death. For another thing, I don't think that writing about him actually helps to secure the larger discursive goals that I'm after here. I think it's just it's pissing into the wind in a lot of cases that people just can't be reached on this subject on either side. So I'd rather write about other more interesting and I think more consequential things than that.
And there are other things going on in the world, you know. So
yeah, but much more important things in the world, certainly too.
I mean, I remember when I was had a daily talk radio show for many years. I had this voice in the back of my head that was like this editor sitting on my head. I could almost feel it saying, if you say X, this is what they will say. This is what will happen if you do this. And I remember sitting down, pretty much consciously saying, if I keep going on like this, I'm going to go crazy. Also, what is the point? What is the point of doing this? If you don't say what you actually think, what is the value added? And that moment when you stop worrying about the consequences in that particular way is an extraordinarily liberating moment. And I wonder whether a lot of the people who are being drawn into conservative media right now who really are being, drawn into this culture where it's all, lockstep propaganda. You must defend. You must attack. Really are, whether or not they understand what they're missing, and the ultimate pointlessness of it. If you write in service of some other cause, which is certainly going to turn out to be unworthy.
Yeah, also people don't fall in love with politicians, and they don't fall in love with you, and don't fall in love with the cause or anything like that. You talk about having a little editor sitting on your shoulder. I've got one of those too, but mine is like, he's sitting there and he's drinking wild turkey and smoking a cigarette and he's not wearing a shirt. He's kind of just angry and problematic and troubling, so he may be worse than I am in some ways.
Okay, so he's angry.
Argue myself out of him.
Do you find that you do your best work when you wake up angry, when you're angry at something and you feel that little burst?
I'm perplexed by this. People often describe me as an angry writer or an angry person.
These are the people who read what you write.
I can write myself up into a rant every now and then, but I don't really think of it that way. I try to write carefully, and I try to write in a way that's entertaining. And sometimes being ranty is entertaining, but I don't get angry about politics exactly very often. Just because I don't think it's worth getting that upset over. For the most part, I think the stakes are actually pretty small right now. I mean, I get angry at dishonesty and pettiness and that sort of thing, and some of the kind of again, this sort of junior high pissant bullying kind of mode of discourse. Sometimes I'll respond to that with, nuclear force if I'm feeling it. But no, I don't write well when I'm feeling much of anything. I try to, get the kind of transparent, emotionally empty state going on there and try to get the words in the right order. And try to convey what the thing is I'm actually trying to convey. I don't think being angry really helps all that much. You know, every time I see one of those bumper stickers that says, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention, I just want to, you know, these people are morons. I mean, they are outraged and they're not paying attention. And it's usually the opposite. It's the other way around. People who know the least tend to have the strongest feelings and be the most angry. And the things that are the actual really important issues are not things that tend to bring out a lot of, you know, emotional amplitude in people. You know, we're actually saying about the fiscal situation in the long term, but it's really, really hard to like have a riot about that or, you know, break down in tears. Because none of this emotional stuff is really about politics. It's about tribe and it's about belonging and status anxiety. So, yeah, I'd like to maybe I should work on that because anger is not mainly what I'm trying to communicate. Although I guess I do in spite of myself sometimes.
Well, this is one of the things I've noticed on Twitter that with the people who get the most angry are the ones who are about to lose their minds. And, you know, watch the process. I mean, you can be clever, you can be witty, you can be sardonic, you can be forceful, you can be eloquent, all of those things. But you can sort of just see when people are about to lose it. And I think that we're living in an age when people have just been losing their minds on a regular basis. So you do not do Twitter. You're staying away from the poo flinging monkeys of Twitter completely.
Yeah, you know, I'm in the second half of my 40s right now, and I still have a feeling that I haven't really done most of the stuff that I'm supposed to do in terms of my writing. So I'm trying to concentrate more on the stuff that I think is most worthwhile. And Twitter's a really good way to procrastinate, and I've got a vulnerability for procrastination anyway. But you know, I go back and look at it, and I originally started doing it as a marketing thing, as a way that I thought would be good to drive traffic to my work. It turns out it's not actually really that effective for that, and especially compared to things like We've Got the Corner at National Review, where we've got, you know, millions of readers on a good day. It's a lot more effective for channeling traffic, I think, than Twitter is. And also, I mean, I'm lucky that I've got a lot of access to radio and television and stuff like that. So if I've got something I really want to draw attention to, I can do. So I don't think Twitter ever really brought out the best in me. And my criticism of this stuff, by the way, by no means do I exempt myself from any of it. I have the same tendencies everyone else does, unfortunately. I wish I didn't, but I do. And so I just don't, I don't think it's really worth the time.
Anybody that's been sucked in would agree with you
at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a job some years ago where we had to get a Facebook account. It was just like a rule of my employer. And so I started using that, and then I stopped, and I took up Twitter sometime later. But other than that, I've never really done much of that kind of stuff. And I just don't think it's useful. I want to write books more than tweets, I think.
Really? Okay. Well,
I don't think I have time to do both.
I sort of went the opposite direction as well. I was on Facebook for a while and have totally abandoned Facebook. Spent way too much time on Twitter. And just simply post dog pictures on Instagram. So that's my division of the universe. Kevin Williamson, thank you. Thank you so much for all your time. I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's always good.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's podcast was brought to you by Simply Safe, and we'll be back tomorrow. We will do this all over again.